depending on how lucky the weather forecasters were this time around, we could still be covered in the white stuff. If they're just wrong as usual, we got a bunch of rain, and I recorded this show when I could be here live. Yes, this is a recorded show, but it's going to be one full of information, so listen closely as you fix another cup of coffee, dry out from a morning of sledding snowball fights, and get over that third bowl of snow cream. Maybe. Whatever the weather or state of the roads, this is Roger Metz, and I'd like to welcome you to another Saturday of Woods and Water, South Carolina. You can listen to this show right there on your radio dial at 94.5 FM or live online at conservativetalk945.com. Just click the Listen Live link on the right side of the page. 94.5 also has a free app for your phone, so you can listen anywhere. Take a look at the Woods and Water SC on Facebook at facebook.com/woodsandwatersc. Don't forget to hit the like button when you're there. Tag your pictures on Instagram at #WoodsAndWaterSCRadio, and you can see more, plus listen to the weekly podcast on the website, woodsandwatersc.com. And that "and" is always spelled out A-N-D. You know, last week was like an episode of The Twilight Zone. A good one, but still an episode of The Twilight Zone. You know, it started out Monday with a Meet the Elites banquet down in Anderson. They were hoping for 1,000 people. Even with the ice and snow, they got about 800, which was a great, great evening for those guys. Benefited Meals on Wheels. You know, next up was practice day, where I rode as a media marshal with Andy Montgomery from Blacksburg, South Carolina. Andy's a, if you remember, he called into the show because he heard his name while he was out fishing on Lake Hartwell, of all things. It was cold and windy, and we just thought it was cold. Andy's a really great guy and has a really cool sponsor named Farm to Feed. They make 100% American-made socks. That means the feed, the sheep, the wool, and the labor are all right here in the USA. Be sure to check them out on the web at farmtofeed.com. Thursday was media day. They served us lunch and then turned us loose on the pros. My first interview, Mike Iaconelli from New Jersey. A really great guy, too. I talked to a lot of people, saw a lot of friends that I had met earlier at other events like ICAST, the FLW. Friday, coldest day in classic history at 10 degrees. Wind chill factor running 65 miles an hour, somewhere around negative 20. And I was on the boat with Skeet Reese from California. I had on 4 layers of clothes, and somebody actually called me the Michelin Man. You should have being the fat Michelin Man, you should have seen me trying to get out of the Skeet's way when a couple of his fish he caught decided to go around the back of the boat. It's one of those days you're glad there are no cameras around. Friday night, I spent with the American Bass Anglers at a dinner. Saw Earl Bentz and was with Neil Paul and Jennifer Norman from Visit Anderson. Those guys did a great job putting on the classic. From there, over to the Costa Party to meet the guys from GeoBass. Saturday was Expo Day, twice, once before the live show and then after it ended. The live remote from the weigh-in was a blast, and I want to thank Joey and James for coming over and making that possible. Gave away a lot of things. If you got something, I hope you enjoyed it. I had Brent Chapman and Terry Scroggins, both Bass Pros, on with me, and Brian Jill from the GeoBass crew. I also need to thank Geddes Brannon for being my wingman. He showed up after a frustrating day and did a good job helping me out. Saturday night, I got the message I was riding on final day of competition with Jacob Wheeler on his Ranger. So another great day with another great fisherman. I drove like a madman to get back to the weigh-in before it started, and that's where we all watched Donald, South Carolina's own Casey Ashley win the 2015 Geico Bassmaster Classic on his home lake. Incredible. I've got so many pictures, videos, and stories to share, but I won't make you endure any more about the Classic unless you want to endure it, and you can find all that you can handle at Woods and Water, South Carolina on the website and the Facebook page, and you can do it on your own time. Now it's back to reality and the calendar of events. The skirmish at Gamble's Hotel, 2015 event schedule, Thursday, March the 5th, gates open for sutlers and reenactors, Friday, March the 6th, demonstrations for area students. They're having to actually tell all vehicles to get out of the camp by 9 o'clock that night. Saturday, March 7th, 7 a.m. Reveille, they have a parade at 8:30. Camps open to the public at 9. They have drills, skirmishes, review passes. They have a barn dance. And Sunday it repeats again. That's the battle at the skirmish at Gamble's Hotel. If you're not sure where that is, it's over in Florence, South Carolina. So make plans to go attend that. Be a great day to spend as a family with a little bit of history. And if you go to their website, it's www.23rdsc.com. They have the event and the directions there on their website. I apologize because I'm not sure how this actually works, but I was on the Clemson Extension website and ran across the 2015 South Carolina 4-H Horsemanship Camp registration page. And I assume it's open now. It's for the purpose of providing youth an opportunity to learn and better their techniques of horsemanship while enjoying the fellowship of other 4-H'ers from across the state. Camp is designed to increase horse knowledge and horsemanship skills from the basics for beginning riders to showing techniques for the advanced riders. You can go to the Clemson Extension office. This one actually takes place at the T. Ed Garrison Arena down in Pendleton, South Carolina. Check that out. It'd be a good program for your budding horsemen. Quality Deer Management is having a oyster roast of all things, and you're invited. The Foothills Branch, the 4th annual oyster roast, is going to take place out at the Fairway Ford Body Shop. That's at Keith Drive in Greenville. You can go to the QDMA website, pick up all the information. It's Friday, March the 6th, time 7 to 9 o'clock. Tickets $35 in advance, $50 at the door. John Stillwell is your contact. His number, 864-414-1879. South Carolina State Parks Moonlight Canoe Float over at Sherall State Park. It's in Sherall, South Carolina. Natural beauty, birds, and wildlife abound on the 361-acre Lake Juniper at Sherall State Park. Come join us for a quiet trip to the headwaters accompanied by a park ranger. Paddle, relax, and enjoy the scenery. We'll leave before sunset, so you can watch the sun go down, and then we paddle back by moonlight. A couple of dates for this one coming up. March the 6th from 5:30 to 8:30. And then in April, after the time changes, 7 to 10 p.m. You can go to the South Carolina State Parks website, look up Sherall State Park, and find out more there. Winya Bay Heritage Festival, Georgetown, South Carolina. Join us at the Kimball Lodge at Hobcall Barony. It's called the Presents Cattails and Cocktails Benefit for the Georgetown County Museum, Saturday, March the 7th. Main reason I pulled this one up, it's got a little saying on here, Pluff Mud makes you strut your stuff. For more information, call 843-545-7020 or look up the Winya Bay Heritage Festival. The Fly Fishing Film Tour. We've got two dates here in South Carolina. One date in South Carolina, one in North Carolina. The 2015 tour is going to be good. This one right here is March the 13th. You can buy your tickets at the Charleston Angler Low Country Fly Shops. You can also buy these online. It's going to be at the Charleston Music Hall. And although you can't call in today, I do have two tickets to the Fly Fishing Film Tour in Charleston, South Carolina for March 13th. Compliments of Low Country Fly Shop. Scotty Davis gave these tickets to me. They're yours. You can't call in, but if you email me, roger@woodsandwatersc.com, the first one that emails me, the tickets are yours. Two tickets. It's a great time. Again, the email roger@woodsandwatersc.com, and you're getting two tickets to the Fly Fishing Film Tour in Charleston at the Charleston Music Hall. Second annual Wild Game Supper, March 14th. This is at Beulah United Methodist Church in Sandy Run, South Carolina. This year's speaker is Jimmy Seitz of Spiritual Adventure Outdoors. He's a seasoned veteran, even served for several years as senior minister at one of the largest churches in Nashville. His speaking engagements have taken him all over the world, to Africa, Mexico, Canada, Central America, the Caribbean, Scotland, Israel, Egypt, and the Ukraine. He's a really cool guy. If you've never seen him, he's very inspiring. Bring the whole family for an evening of fun, kids' activities, live music, and the wild game you've always wanted to try. Tickets are $10. You can contact Beulah United Methodist Church or check out their website, and I don't have it here. But anyway, you can find it. Second annual Wild Game Supper at Beulah United Methodist Church. Culinary Chef Camp with Chef Laurie. This is going to be at Santee State Park, March the 17th. There's a registration deadline of 1 week prior to, but it says gather around the stove and make a campfire for Culinary Chef Camp with Chef L'Oreal. There's an ordinary cooking class who has cooked. She's cooked for the president of world-class spas and appeared on the Dr. Oz show. She'll lead you through prep, cooking, and eating a delicious and healthy meal during the two-night program. Sounds like a good time. You actually have to provide lodging. You can do that right there at the park. So you can do find more information here at the Santee State Park website. It's a little bit far out there, but you need to get your reservations in. The second fly fishing film tour location is going to be sponsored by Hunter Banks and Southern Culture on the Fly. That's March 19th, Asheville, North Carolina, at Highland Brewing Company. Doors open at 5 o'clock. Films start at 7. Food is available, and it's good food. I was there last year. Probably won't be able to make it this year, but a good night to go to Asheville and see some fly fishing films. The last one on the calendar for this week is one that is close to us. That's Glendale Outdoor Leadership School. You heard Jay Ellison here on the show talk about this. This is the Solo Wilderness First Aid Course. It's free. He actually sent me an email, said he's had more than a few people who've listened to this show sign up for these classes. The next class is at Devil's Fork State Park. It's full. After that, you've got the March 21st to 22nd course at Glendale right there over near Spartanburg. And then March 28th through 29th, Hickory Knob State Park. They're free. It covers things like wilderness survival, anatomy of a wilderness crisis, heat-related injuries, patient lifting and moving, rescue plan, and my favorite, sprains and strains. I'll add all these to the Facebook page. I'll give you the time, date, location, and website. Make sure you check them out a few days before you go, just to make sure nothing's changed. On the phone with us today, we've got Chad Holbrook, who's a freshwater fisheries biologist with the Department of Natural Resources. I went down to meet him at Bono, tour of the St. Stephen's Fish Lift, and just had a ball, really informative, and we're lucky enough to have Chad with us today on the show. Chad, thank you for calling in. How are you?
Doing good. How's everybody doing today?
Well, we're up here getting ready for a snowstorm. I've seen it anywhere from 1 to 3 all the way up to 10 inches. That's why we're recording this instead of doing it live on Saturday. So kind of both of us got our schedules thrown to, you know, the dogs. But anyway, it's a good thing. I appreciate you being here. Like I said, there's so much information you had to give me that it was hard to absorb it all. And I think we just kind of take it like we did when I was there. I met you. We toured the striper ponds, went to the research facility, the eel ladder, which was really cool, and finished up the fish lift. So let's just get started. When we were out there and I met you, there are 54 ponds that raise stripers. Tell us about those ponds.
All right. Yeah. We have a facility in Bono, the Dennis Wildlife Facility, and we have 52 hatchery ponds located on the property, and those ponds are anything from a half an acre up to an acre. And in the spring of the year, all of those ponds are in production to raise striped bass fingerlings to be stocked all throughout the state. In a given year, we can harvest anywhere from probably 3.5 up to 4.5 million striped bass fingerlings. And when I say a striped bass fingerling, I'm just talking about a fish that's about, you know, anywhere from 1.5 inches to maybe 2 inches long. So, you know, we're producing about 3.5 to 4.5 million of those, and then they're stocked out all throughout the state in any of the reservoirs that you could think of that have striped bass populations, all the way from Lake Hartwell and Lake Murray down to the Santee Cooper system.
And it's interesting that we stock stripers here in South Carolina. Oof. Because we only have one naturally reproducing population in South Carolina. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's here in the Santee Cooper Reservoir System, and that has a lot to do with the length of the river at the head of the reservoir. Really defines whether or not striped bass are going to be able to reproduce naturally. And, you know, above Lake Marion, we've got this nice long stretch of river that runs all the way to Columbia.
Right.
So striped bass are able to spawn naturally. And in our other systems, like in the Savannah chain, those reservoirs are kind of stacked up one on top of the other. So there's not a big long river reach in between. So in order to have striped bass there, we have to stock them.
And you were telling me that when these fingerlings come to you, they're really, man, they're really, really small.
Yes.
And they actually are eating plankton and that sort of thing that's in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And How long does it take them? Now, we're going to get to the research building where you actually, you know, you get the eggs and then you fertilize the eggs and hatch them. When they come to you, how long does it take them to get from being slightly bigger than microscopic to an inch or so?
They're in the rearing ponds here on the facility for about 30 to 40 days.
Okay.
And that's depending on how warm the water is. If the water is warmer, it's closer to 30 days. And early in the season, when the water's a little bit cooler, those fish can be in the ponds for, you know, closer to 40 days.
Okay. And you actually get your water right there from the lakes, don't you? I mean, we rode up on the big dike and all, and you showed me how the water comes down. So when they are brought there, you were telling me that it's the same water their parents were raised in.
Correct, yeah. So we fill all the ponds with reservoir water straight from Lake Moultrie. And a lot of the brood fish are also from the Santee Cooper system. We catch them below Panopolis Dam and below the St. Stephens Dam and upstream of St. Stephens Dam. So the brood fish are there from Lake Moultrie, and then the fry go right back into Lake Moultrie water in our ponds and are reared there.
And that actually helps them because there's no adjustment to the salinity or anything of that water. That's where their parents were raised, so it's just a natural environment for them.
Right.
So we left there, and you did find out. I know when we were down there, we wanted to know how many fish you raised down there, so you did find that out for me, and I appreciate that. That's a tremendous amount of stripers.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, all that is dependent upon what kind of request the hatchery folks, you know, get
right.
from regional biologists.
Right.
Each one of our regions puts in a request for fish, and, you know, it's then the hatchery staff job to try to meet that request, and they do a great job of meeting those requests every year.
And you make the best use of it, because when I was down there, there were a few ponds that were in production, and you raised bluegills in the off season.
That's correct. Yeah, bluegill production, you know, will start after the striped bass harvest. And the striped bass harvest is typically in May, and then bluegills will go in late spring, early summer, around June. And the good thing about bluegill is they'll spawn, as long as the water is warm, just about every 35 or 40 days. And so you end up with the, you know, very large crop of young bluegill that can be harvested then in November and December and even on up into when you were here in January.
Right. Well, we left there and we drove to, I guess, what you would call your research facility out near the Reed Diversion Canal. Tell us a little bit about that place.
All right. Yeah, we have it's called the Jack Bayless Hatchery on the Reed Diversion Canal. And what we do there is it's really an egg facility. You know, we bring those fry back here to the hatchery, but in order to have those fry, we got to start with the eggs.
That's right.
To make them. So that's their area where we bring brood fish into the hatchery system with striped bass and American shad. We then produce the fry and then bring the fry to the ponds to hatch. Now, the process for the American shad and the striped bass is a little different for each
right.
species. You know, we let the American shad spawn on their own in the tanks, and the striped bass, we manually spawn those fish. We strip spawn them.
Okay. And that wasn't happening while I was there. That will happen when?
The American shad will come on site. From talking with the hatchery folks, I believe they're going to do it the second week of March. They'll start bringing American shad into the hatchery.
Okay.
And it'll take anywhere from probably 10 days to 2 weeks before those shads start to spawn in the hatchery.
Yeah.
Striped bass, they'll start bringing those guys in probably the second week of April.
Okay.
And they'll have spawning going on for a couple of weeks there with striped bass. And once for the hatchery people, when they start bringing fish into the hatchery, that hatchery becomes a 24-hour operation. Just because it's a really, really critical time when you've got a lot of eggs going like that. So, you know, the hatchery folks put in a lot of long hours for about 3 or 4 weeks of the year, just making sure we get through those really critical early stages of a fish life.
And that's when your wife, who we've had on this show before, Pam, that's when she really shines, is when the American shad come in and she's there working on them.
That's right, yep. She really enjoys getting to take part in that.
And she's a very talented artist, by the way. I don't know if everybody knows this, but South Carolina implemented a angler appreciation program. And it's kind of to make up, if you don't catch a record-setting state fish, they do have kind of a second-place prize where if you have a really nice brown trout, striper, and there's a couple of more crappy, where you get a certificate from the Department of Natural Resources, and your wife is actually the one who did those drawings.
She did, yep. And, you know, it's a program that not only is we want to do something for those anglers that catch a fish that's, you know, worth recognizing, it also can help us out in the department. You know, we get a lot of phone calls from people, and a lot of people want to come and visit our state to catch a big fish, or somebody that already lives in the state would like to know where they could go and have the best chance of catching a trophy fish. And if we can get enough angler participation in this program, we'll be able to share that information with everybody out there. We have the website that's up now, and there's a few pictures of fish that were turned in and submitted to the program in 2014. We're just getting that program off the ground, so the more folks that know about it and the more folks that participate, the more success it'll be.
Well, I did not know it was for a marketing campaign, but that makes sense. You got lots of big fish showing up in your lakes, and people want to come in and catch one and get some recognition. That's, well, that just makes sense. All right. That thing is in operation. You showed me a really cool, I guess, a trailer with all the blue drums on it and the discharge pipes and all. That was designed right there on site, was it not?
That was. Our hatchery overall coordinator down here is Forrest Sessions, and he's been on the job for probably more than 25 years and has a really good mind for everything that goes along with the hatchery work. And he designed it's really a little hauling trailer that we haul those really fragile fish that are less than a week old, because we have to take them from the hatchery and bring them back here
right
to the rearing pond. And those kind of fish can't handle very much change in their water quality or anything along those lines. And Forrest has come up with a design that really minimizes mortality of those fish. And it's really unique. And if you ever get a chance to visit the hatchery, make sure you ask them about it. And he'll be glad to tell you how that works.
It was a really neat thing. I was impressed. You'd be sure to tell him that.
All right.
We went from that facility down to, I guess, what would be called the backside of the lock or the fish lift there. And there was a long metal, I don't know, a chute, I guess you would call it. And I couldn't figure it out when we got there. It's actually an eel ladder. We're going to take a break here for the bottom of the hour, but when we come back, we'll get back to our conversation with Chad Holbrook and talk a little bit more about the eel ladder. Sorry, my voice is cracking a little bit today. More than a few cold mornings out on Lake Hartwell will do that to you. Airborne can only take you so far. It did a great job of getting me through. I wanted to emphasize, this is only open for 30 days. This is one of the only facilities on the East Coast. It's so informative. You learn a lot. And I think it's one of those things, if you have time, Bono, you know, it's between the lakes. It's not very easy to get to, but it's well worth the trip for you and your family, your kids, your class. Like I said, they're there. They'll give you tours. Reservations are recommended because they get really busy and you want to make sure you get in. Hang on through the break. We'll be back on the other side. Continue with more of our interview with Chad Holbrook from the Department of Natural Resources. Ooh. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. You're listening to a recorded show. Maybe you've just come in from playing in the snow and didn't hear the first part of it. You can always catch the podcast on the website. But we're talking to Chad Holbrook. He's a freshwater fisheries biologist with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. And we're talking about the St. Stephen's Fish Lift. Yes, we have a fish lift here in South Carolina. Most people hear fish lifts, ladders, they think of the Pacific Northwest, Alaska, where there's sea-run salmon. But we actually have one right here in South Carolina. It's a very interesting facility to visit. It's open to the public for a month. Hope you get out and visit it, enjoy it, learn something. We left off the last segment. We're just starting to talk about the eel ladder. I think you'll find it really interesting, and eels are not as slimy and gross as most people think they are. They're actually pretty cute. So anyway, we'll get back to this conversation with Chad. When it's over, we'll come back, have some more of news and events across the state. Now, for most people in the upstate, I'm sure most people probably in South Carolina think of eels as slimy and disgusting and all, but it's really neat. Would you take us through just a little bit of, and you're still working on a lot of research with eels, would you take us through a little bit of what happens with the eels as they come out from the sea, come up the rivers, and especially when they hit that eel ladder? It was just a really neat aspect of the whole operation down there.
Okay. Yeah. Eels are one of those creatures that are really fascinating. And they have a very complicated life history, and I could talk for a long time, but I'll try to be brief about it. So adult eels from all over the East Coast swim out to the Sargasso Sea, which is an area kind of south of Bermuda, but north of the Bahamas, out in the ocean. We've never really pinpointed where they all go to spawn. It's a large area out there. But so all the eels get together out there, and they spawn. And then their larvae then kind of drift on the ocean current, the Gulf Stream, and come up along the Atlantic coast, and it takes them about a year for those larvae to reach back to the Atlantic coast. And once they do, the larvae start entering into the freshwater streams along the coast. Something like the Santee River. So those larvae, they're about a year old there. When they hit the Santee River mouth, they are completely transparent. They are about probably 2 to 3 inches long. They look like a worm that's just completely glassy. So okay. At that stage, they're called a glass eel.
All right.
And they'll start their way up the Santee River, and, it takes them, they're small, and they're fighting that current, and it takes them a little while, and by the time they make it up to where the St. Stephen's eel ramp was, where we were at, they've been in fresh water for, anywhere from maybe 6 to 12 months. They've become pigmented, just meaning that their body has become colored. They're kind of brown,
right,
like the ones we saw the day you were there.
Right.
And, at that point, they're anywhere from 4 to 6 inches long. So what we have there is really like you described it. It's just an aluminum trough that sets at the base of the St. Stephen Dam. We have water that continually flows down this trough, and we have a material inside of it called an Inca mat, and that's a fancy word for really just a carpet.
Right.
It's kind of like an indoor-outdoor carpet that the eels can kind of grab onto a little bit and work their way up this little ramp. On the top side of the ramp, we have a catch bucket that once the eels get to the top, they drop on over into that catch bucket, and we're able to go down there every 1 to 2 days and check what's in the bucket. We weigh and measure everything, and then we carry them up over the dam, the St. Stephen Dam, and release them into Lake Moultrie. And that's really the whole purpose of the project, is to be able to move these eels up over the dam, because an eel in the wild, that's part of what they want to do, is to work their way well inland on any rivers in the state that don't have dams, such as the Edisto or the Great PD, which isn't dammed until you get on up in North Carolina.
Right.
You know, we have eels that go, you know, 200 and 300 miles inland. So we're in the Santee Cooper system. We're trying to give them a leg up and get them back over the dam and give them a chance to get back further upriver where they want to spend their adult life.
That was a really neat something. I had no idea we even had were eels. I know cobia fishermen like to use them for bait. These are not quite that big. I think the ones we saw were mostly 4, 5, 6 inches long. And he just dip netted out, put them in a bucket, and then when later on we were in the actual fish lift, he was there measuring and weighing each one of them. And you have captured those eels. How far inland did you tell me? All the way to the watery dam?
We have. Yeah, we've done a real small scale tagging study on some of these eels where we put a colored plastic underneath their skin, a really small little piece of colored plastic that fluoresces under a certain type of flashlight.
Okay.
And so we've released those eels into Lake Moultrie that we've tagged, and we've set up eel traps, which is basically just a ramp with a bucket, the same sort of setup at the base of Watery Dam. And we have collected eels that we've turned loose in St. Stephen. They have been collected at Watery Dam. I don't know how many miles that is.
It's a long straight way.
Yeah. And you'd have to consider, too, that these eels aren't going to go straight line miles.
Right.
Once they hit Lake Marion, it's really hard to say what they do. You know, they may go in some of the backwaters and hang out for a little while. But,
right.
The time difference between that is it took about, I want to say it's close to 2 years from the time we turned them loose at St. Stephen's until we called them again at Lake Watery.
Absolutely incredible. And now we get to the real gem of St. Stephen's, and that's the fish lift. And you were telling me as we actually started in the door, you said, you know, we're real proud because the Corps of Engineers gave us a lot of money, and they actually have redone the whole entranceway and the observation room. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yep. So it was about 2 or 3 years ago, and the Corps of Engineers, you know, we've had a viewing room and tours ongoing in this facility for probably 15 years. And visitation has been up and down throughout that period. But some of the folks that work in the Charleston office of the Army Corps of Engineers decided that it was really a showcase area for what we had here in St. Stephen's with the fish lift. It's a one-of-a-kind thing in South Carolina. It's really, as far as the East Coast goes, there's very few fish passage facilities like this on the East Coast. And so they wanted to make it really visitor-friendly. So the Army Corps folks put in a lot of hard work and redid the floors and the walls and the ceilings. And then on our end, we went in and redid all of our educational information and tried to make it look more like what you would see possibly in an aquarium as you enter in.
It's very fishy and full of history.
It is. Yes. And that's what we want folks to be able to do. We want someone to be able to come there and hopefully, you know, spend an hour with us, and just check out all the information we have on the different species of fish with blueback herring and American shad and American eel and the history of just the rediversion project in and of itself.
Which is one of my dad's favorite subjects. He loves Santee Cooper, the lakes, and it's the structural engineer in him. I think the process gets him, the ongoing operation gets him, the whole, that just appeals to him a lot. He really enjoys the whole Santee Cooper environment down there.
It is fascinating. You know what, the one thing that always strikes me anytime I see how the reservoirs were constructed, was just the sheer amount of people that worked on it. You know, it was kind of, there was some mechanization when those reservoirs were built, but it's not like what we would see now.
Not even close.
No. So there were a lot of people, and they got the work done really fast. Much faster than it seems like we would get a project like that done now.
That's because you had people that were driven back then. All right, so we've got you walk in through a hallway. It's got all the history on either side of you. You empty out into an observation room with a couple of windows. When people come in there and sit down, what are they going to see through those windows?
Okay, so when you're sitting there at the windows, and I also want to let folks on the radio know that if they can't make it down to see through the windows with us this year or any year that they think they may not be able to, they can log on to our website and watch those windows from the comfort of their home on the computer. We've got a couple of webcams that are up and running. But we'll get back to what we'll see coming through the windows.
So all right.
What we're going to be looking for are American shad and blueback herring, mostly.
Okay.
Those are our anadromous fish that use that facility. And the word anadromous just means that they are fish that were born in the fresh water. They swam back out to the ocean and lived in the ocean for, 3 to 5 years. And then as adults, they need to return back to that fresh water and return to the river where they were born in order to spawn again. Kind of the same story that you might be familiar with Pacific salmon.
Right. Which is what you think of when you think of fish lifts and all that. You think of the Pacific Northwest.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's where the majority of places like that in the United States are. So that's kind of why we're unique here in South Carolina to have this facility for folks to come and see. So as you sit in the viewing room, we have a tour guide there also who will be filling you in on what to expect. But when we do a lift, you could see, that's the flip of the coin is you don't know exactly what you're going to see. You may see a 50-pound catfish swim by the window, or you may see 10,000 American shad swim by the window. That would be on the upper end of what we would see in a lift.
Okay.
The day you and I were there, it was pretty cold, and we didn't see a whole lot going on there.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's still real early in the season. Kind of the peak of our season is mid-March to early April. And on average, what you could expect is probably a couple of hundred American shad in a lift and maybe 1,000 blueback herring in a lift.
And you lift every hour, correct?
We lift every hour on the hour unless we have just an abundance of fish, and then we'll lift every half hour.
Okay.
But our typical schedule is on the hour, and so that helps folks, too, that want to look at the webcam. They know that if they log in around the top of the hour, you'll have a better chance of seeing fish go by the window.
Most people won't get the tour that I got, which I feel very privileged to have gotten, but you actually took me out on top, and the shaft is scary. I was standing on top, kind of had a railing around it. I took one glance over and said, nope, that's not enough for me. I'm glad my camera has this little flip-up screen so I could put it out over the edge and take pictures of it. How deep is that shaft?
I believe that chamber is about a 75-foot chamber. So that's the difference in the elevation from the downstream side of the dam to the reservoir side of the dam. So, how it works is fish are swimming in from the river on the downstream tailrace side of the dam. They enter into a chamber. That chamber is then closed behind them, and it fills with water. And we have a basket that lifts fish up through that chamber as it fills with water. And it fills up, the 75 feet or so that you could see. And when they get to the top, then the gate on the reservoir side is opened up, and the fish are then able to swim out. So kind of the best way to think of it is it's an elevator for fish. It's not like a salmon ladder that
right.
you might have seen where the fish take little stair steps and go up.
Right.
This is all at once. They ride the elevator up about probably 5 or 6 stories.
Okay.
And then they come to the reservoir side, and we open the elevator doors, and they swim on out into the lake.
Now, when they do swim out, depending on what time of the year, that's when you catch them, and you have a little block exit trap that you can funnel fish to?
We do, yeah. We have a couple of different reasons that we need to catch some of the fish that go out. Most of the fish, they swim right on out into the reservoir, and we don't harass them anymore. But a few of them are the lucky guys that get to go spend some time with Pam in the hatchery. we have about, I would say about 300 a year become brood fish in our hatchery system.
Okay.
So we'll trap and catch about 300 there. And then sometimes we need to take some length and weight measurements just to get an idea of what our trends look like each week. So we may go down and sample, you know, a couple hundred fish throughout the season just to see what size fish are moving through and if it's been similar to previous years.
Wow, that's a lot to cover. Well, you're open when? When can the public come down and see what I got to see?
We are open to the public from March 15th to April 15th, and I realize that's a pretty short window of time in the year, but the reason for that is we want to kind of ensure that folks get a good experience while they're there. So in that time frame, that's the time when you're going to see something going through the window. You're either going to see American shad or blueback herring, and we're trying to just make the experience as good as we can. Our operating hours are Monday through Friday from 9 to 3 a.m. for our tours.
Okay.
If you want to come on a weekend, we can do that too. We've got a tour guide, and he's available to work on the weekends. So we're not open for walk-up visitors, but we are open for reservations on a Saturday or Sunday. And to make one of those reservations, you can call us here in the office in Bono, and that phone number is 843-825-3387.
Chad, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate all the hard work you can do down there. Am I invited back to when Pam is there working her magic?
Absolutely. Yeah, we would we'd love to have you back and have you be able to see the hatchery when it's in full swing, because that's really impressive as well. I think you'll really enjoy yourself.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, sharing with us. I hope a lot of people that hear your voice over the upstate will say, you know what, let's make a trip to Bono starting middle of next month and see what it's all about firsthand.
Sure, yeah. Come on down and see us.
All right, appreciate it, Chad, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, Roger.
Yes, sir.
Bye.
You know, I love going and doing things like that. Going and touring, getting it firsthand, coming back here, setting up with someone that's there who does this for a living, who can talk it. Chad knows his stuff. And that's not all we covered. There is no way I could cover with you or have him cover with you what we went over while we were there. We didn't even get to the numbers. Somewhere around 400,000 shad will go through the fish lift in a month, and around 600,000 herring will go from the rediversion canal up into the lake systems during that month, along with 100, just stripers and catfish and whatever the fish get caught in the lift. It's a truly unique experience, a unique place, and a process. I was really impressed. I hope you'll make time to go. If not, log on to the website, watch the cameras. He was telling me they've got two now. They've got one that's, of course, facing one way across the hatchery chute and one facing the other. So you can watch it online from the comfort of your house if you can't get down there. But I encourage you to go. You heard him talk about the Angler Appreciation Program. Participate in it because it's going to help them with their research. I was in a group chat the other night, and we were talking about coyotes because coyotes are becoming more and more of a story with South Carolina deer hunting and deer populations and all. And we got into a little, I wouldn't call it an internet argument, but had somebody question some numbers, because the numbers are that hunters kill about 30,000 coyotes a year. Trappers take about 2,500. And somebody was asking me where I had those figures from, and I didn't want to, those figures came from Jay Butfoloski he's the fur bearer biologist with the Department of Natural Resources. I didn't want to get into it, but he kept questioning. So I pulled out my deer hunter survey. Actually, it's titled the Deer Hunter Survey, South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. I had it. It's a voluntary thing, but I want to encourage you to fill it out, because this is where they get the information they need to manage our deer herds. And the question was, how do you know that hunters take that many coyotes? And at the bottom of your deer hunter survey is a question. It's question number 9. If you harvested any wild hogs or coyotes while hunting in South Carolina in 2014, please complete the box below. And that's where they get those figures from. So it's important for us, when we get these surveys, not just to throw them in the corner and forget about it. This is how our Department of Natural Resources gets the information they need to manage our herds for us. So participate. Be a good steward. But, yeah, there's a lot of news coming on coyotes. There's a lot of news coming with the deer regulations, deer populations. We're going to have Dr. Charles Ruth on. We're going to have Senator Chip Campson come on, talk about his bill. That's all upcoming. I don't know how we're going to pack it all in. Look at the schedule going through March and into April, and it is just full. But we'll get to it somehow or another because, hey, you need to know these things. I got a little wrap-up to do here for the Bassmasters Classic. Bear with me. At the same time, the pros were fishing. The collegiate guys were fishing. Got to give a round of applause and congratulations to the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. They won the Carhartt Bassmaster Classic Sunday. Their anglers brought in 5 fish, 9 pounds, 6 ounces. And this is pretty neat because not only did they win the Carhartt Bassmaster College Classic, they also just won a national championship title in bass fishing. So congratulations to those guys. The anglers, Andrew Helms and Jake Whitaker, they actually beat out a team from Clemson by just 4 ounces. And just 1 ounce behind the two guys from Clemson were two guys from the University of South Carolina, Hampton Anderson and Josh Rennebaum. So congratulations to those college guys. If you were out at the expo, at the launches, the weigh-ins, you saw how many kids were out there. Just an incredible amount of kids, and that's what we have to do. We've got to get these kids involved, because if we don't have a next generation of fishermen, we don't have people that care anymore. There were two articles that came out about the classic. The first was written by Scott Kiefner at the Greenville News. It says, given the fact that last weekend's Bassmasters Classic attracted the third largest attendance in the 45-year history of the event, it may not be difficult for the upstate to lure what's known as the Super Bowl of bass fishing back to the area. The Classic's return to Lake Hartwell is pretty much guaranteed. I think BASS was very happy, even with the cold weather. The attendance, 103,000 people went through the doors all those 3 days. More than 10,000 fans packed the Bon Secours Arena for the final weigh-in. Economic impact, somewhere between 17 and 23 million, which is a lot of money. And if you were out there, you see there's a lot of money in bass fishing. One of my favorite memories from the Classic, practice day morning, we're at the Hilton Hotel getting on the bus, and there's a guy there from Ontario, Canada, Cathal Kelly. Cathal Kelly was his name. And we have bags of clothes and motorcycle helmets, and he's there in just a jacket and boots and a scarf. And I ask him where his gear was, and he says, what gear? Just a great guy. He wrote an incredible article. He writes for a newspaper in Ontario, Canada. I've got the articles. I'm waiting for permission to put them up. But talk about a way to give you an insight. Now, he does not cover hunting and fishing. He is a sports writer, basketball, hockey, that sort of thing. And his article is so good. It will suck you in. Wow. It was incredible. But he nearly died. Let's just put it that way. He said he could not feel his hands or his feet. He rode with Michael Iaconelli on Wednesday. Just a great guy. Great article. I saw him several times over the week. And he was just having the time of his life. He said, who would have known bass fishing was such a big thing? So that's my take on the Bassmaster Classic. It will come back around. We're in the rotation, especially with the Green Pond Landing and our ability to put on a show this big means that we will get it back. And with that, we're getting close to the end of another show. I hope it snowed for us out there. Maybe not. Chuck Norris for this week. Chuck Norris does not need Twitter because he's already following you. Classic was quite a show, and if you missed it, well, you missed a lot. Don't make that mistake the next time it or the FLW Cup comes to town. You do realize that the FLW Cup was won by South Carolina native son Anthony Gagliardi on his home lake, Lake Murray, just last August. Woods and Water was there. Now South Carolina native son Casey Ashley has won the Bassmaster Classic on his home lake, Lake Hartwell. I guess that would be something like the Clemson Tigers winning the Rose Bowl and the South Carolina Gamecocks winning the Orange Bowl in the same season. Incredible stories for both anglers. It's time to start thinking about summer camp. So next week, we're going to talk to Dan Dupree with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources Camp Wildwood. Camp Wildwood is a three-year progressive camp, and I think Dan is going to bring in a few campers that went through all 3 years. We'll also be starting to talk about the Palmetto Sportsman Classic. The Classic is March 27th through the 29th, and Woods and Water will be there along with Outdoor Underwriters, the sponsor of this show. The Classic is a good time. The marquee guest this year, Captain Wild Bill Rakroski from the Discovery Channel show Deadliest Catch. Mark those days on your calendar. Drive to the State Fairgrounds in Columbia. See all the vendors. Eat some good food. Meet Wild Bill. Stop by the booth and say hello. I might even bring Sophie along for the weekend. She loves people to pet her. Be sure you come by and see us. There's James in the background, so that's all for another week. I survived the Classic, the coldest one in record. Hope the snow was all they said it would be, and you got to spend some time outdoors with family. For once, I hope you didn't take the back roads, but did take lots of pictures. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll talk to you again next week. Hit me from behind, 'cause I'm gone.